she could intervene. He assented, but with some misgivings. Thracia was renowned for training female Jedi, not for preparing young males. Anakin, your powers someday could be beyond those of anyone in this room. But what happens when you push something harder?
It moves faster, Anakin said.
Thracia dropped her hands from his shoulders.
Obi-Wan?
Moving faster gives you so little time to consider, Obi-Wan continued where she had left off. You must temper your passions, but be less concerned for now with being free from your pain. Youth is a time of uncertainty and unrest.
Couldn't have put it better myself, Thracia said.
Anakin, be a child. Revel in it. Test your limits. Irritate and provoke. It is your way. Time enough for wisdom when you've worn more holes in your shoes. Run your master ragged. It'll be good for him. It'll remind him of when he was a boy. And tell us what you need, now, to go where you must finally go in your training.
Anakin looked around the room, realizing that whatever the mood at the beginning of the meeting, there was little chance now of his being expelled from the temple. Thracia had made her point, as only she could, by lightly stinging them all.
I need a job, a mission, he said, his voice cracking with emotion. I need something to do, something real.
How can we give you our trust? Mace asked, leaning forward and staring at the boy.
Anakin did not avert his eyes. The power of his spirit, of his personality, was almost frighteningly apparent.
Indeed, Padawan, how can we trust you after all these errors? Thracia asked, her voice level. It is one thing to be what you are, quite another to drag others into danger.
Anakin stared at her for long seconds, searching her face as he might look over a map trying to find his way home.
I never make the same mistake twice, he finally said, blinking slowly. He faced the other council members. I'm not stupid.
I agree, Thracia said.
Mace, give these two something useful to do rather than stewing in the temple pot.
I was approaching that conclusion, Mace said.
Taking all day and terrifying the boy, Thracia exclaimed.
Anakin is not easily frightened, not by us, Mace said wryly.
Thracia, there must be another reason you came here today.
How observant, she said.
The danger grows daily, and our enemies, whoever they are, within the Senate or without, may again try to target our students before they're ready to defend themselves.
Thracia flapped out her sleeves and sat in an empty council seat beside Mace.
You sent my former apprentice, Verger, on a mission, and we have heard nothing from her in a year.
Verger is self-reliant, as Jedi are trained to be. It is possible she has extended her mission or found another. In any case, I request that Obi-Wan Kenobi be sent as backup.
With me? Anakin asked, his face eager.
He remembered Verger, an intense, trim, and diminutive female who had treated him with polite reserve, as if he were an adult. He had liked her. He had especially liked the patterns of feathers and short whiskers around her face and her large, quizzical eyes.
Would this be a long mission? Obi-Wan asked.
To the far side of the galaxy, far beyond the rule of the Republic, Mace said. If we agree.
A chance for adventure and growth, away from the seethe and intrigue of the capital world, Thracia said.
Obi-Wan, you are not enthusiastic?
Obi-Wan stepped forward.
If the temple is in danger, I would rather stay and defend it.
Mace's somber face showed he shared some of Obi-Wan's concerns, but not all. He raised his hand.
Matters are not yet at crisis on Coruscant. That may be decades away.
While you are gone, Obi-Wan, we can probably fend for ourselves.
Mace's lips cracked the faintest of smiles.
A Padawan must attend his master.
Anakin, do you agree?
Of course, absolutely,
Anakin squirmed with the hope of being out from under so many critical eyes.
Is the meeting over?
In due time, Mace said, eyes languid once more.
Now, explain to me again how you got involved in this race.
Anakin lay on the cot in his small room, twirling a droid verbobrain in his hands. He ran his hands over his short hair and peered deep into the unit's connectors. He did not like the fact that he had won.
It seemed wrong that he had stepped out of line so far, and yet had been retained as a Padawan. He did not like the sensations this victory, if victory it was, produced in him. Above all weaknesses, arrogance was the most costly. "They keep me here because I have potential they've never seen before," Anakin thought to himself. "They keep me in training because they're curious to see what I can do. I feel like a rich man who never knows whether his friends are true or whether they just want his credits." This was a particularly galling thought, and certainly neither true nor fair. Why do they put up with me, then? Why do I keep testing them? They tell me to use my pain, but sometimes I don't even know where the pain comes from.
A compact protocol droid filled a corner of the room. Anakin stood and lifted the droid's access panel, inserted the verbobrain, and arranged the leads at different test points. Criticality lights showed that this unit could direct its own actions once more. Another droid repaired. The Jedi had no use for them, but they were yet one more eccentricity they somehow tolerated. Usually. One of Anakin's smaller droids, a fancy home repair model he'd picked up half-crushed on the street, had been found in the council chamber, repairing light fixtures that did not need repair. That one had been returned to him neatly cut in half, the edges fused in an easily recognizable way. A comparatively gentle warning. Anakin took some comfort in this. Too much tolerance for deviation showed weakness, and the blood carver's attempt on his life indicated there was real danger on Coruscant. He sucked in a deep breath and resolved that these were probably the only people in the galaxy who could teach and train and direct him. And of course, the weight of that job lay on Obi-Wan, whom Anakin loved and respected, and for that reason needed to test all the more. Tomorrow they would leave Coruscant, the destination not yet specified. He needed to get some sleep. Anakin dreaded sleep. It seemed in his dreams that something inside was testing him, something very strong, and it did not care whether it was loved or feared. Thracia Cholim accompanied Obi-Wan and Anakin onto the passenger ramp of the orbital transport. "Verger was my most able apprentice," she said. "I was with her from the time she was an infant fresh from her egg. She herself chose this mission." Thracia handed Obi-Wan a small data card. "The details are too sensitive to talk about here. When you are with Charza Quinn, he will give you another card necessary to unlock the contents. Charza may seem a little difficult, a little strange, but he has served the Jedi well for over a century. I entrusted Verger to him, and now I entrust you. May the Force be with you." The transport carried them effortlessly into space. Anakin sat in the forward compartment as Obi-Wan closed his eyes and meditated in the seat across from him.
"Master, this isn't the mission you wanted, is it?"
Obi-Wan opened his eyes. His meditation had not gone very far, just to the edge of a simple unity with the Force, and he returned easily enough. "I have learned to accept what the Council assigns us," he said.
"Where do you go when you meditate?" Anakin asked.
Obi-Wan smiled at the boy's chatter. "To a state of mind and body where I reacquaint myself with simplicity." Anakin wrinkled his nose.
"I don't meditate very often."
"I've noticed."
"I get to a certain point, and I just overload. It's like I'm plugging into a supernova or something. Something goes bluey in me. I don't like it."
Anakin had not told him this before. Getting away from the temple was already showing benefits. Thracia had been right. "We should work on that during our journey." Once in orbit, the transport quickly sidled up to a transfer dock. Anakin recognized the class of ship on the opposite side of the dock. A small cargo transport, probably a modified YT-1150. Judging from the changes Anakin could see in the nacelle that held the outboard stabilizers and the hyperdrive integrator, the modifications easily made it a Class 0.8, faster than anything in the Republic or the Trade Federation listings. Anakin eagerly watched as the connection tunnels linked. The smell of the air inside changed drastically. Charza Quinn's ship smelled like an ocean, Obi-Wan thought. A not very fresh tide pool. Charza Quinn was a male preapulin. In a galaxy of a great variety of life forms, which any cosmopolitan traveler would find unremarkable, Preapulins still looked like an angler's bad dream. Obi-Wan had heard of this legendary auxiliary to the Jedi, many times, of course, but was still not quite prepared for his actual presence. Most worms were without backbone. Charizer had 5 knobby notochords arranged around his tubular length. He stretched at least 4 meters from tip to tail when fully straightened, which was rare. As he greeted his 2 travelers, he was curled like a squashed hook. His eyes rose in 3 pairs along the upper curve of this hook. His underside was covered with a brush of thick bristles that constantly rubbed against each other as if in speculation. His lower tail, or foot, rode on a similar stiff brush, scrubbing with a hiss through the thin film of water that covered the floor. Along his outside edges, long, flexible spines stuck out like the fringe of a starched carpet. Anakin was most fascinated by the shapes of these spines. Some were like tiny hooks. Others were spatulate, and still others formed tiny, thorny balls. Charza Quinn used them as hundreds of exquisitely capable fingers.
"Welcome to the Star Sea Flower," he greeted them. "Good once more to have Jedi accompany me between the stars."
Charza spoke by rubbing bristles together near his spiracles, his breathing vents. That he spoke at all was remarkable. That his speech was clear and his words disarmingly friendly was startling. The darkened and damp interior of Charza's ship was enlivened by small wriggling things. Larger animals hid in corners and peered out as he escorted Obi-Wan and Anakin through his ship. Pumps and filters whined faintly and kept the water as refreshed as could be expected. Obi-Wan took all this in stride, though he hoped there were special quarters for passengers less aquatic than Charza. "It's an honor to work with you, Charza Quinn," the Jedi Knight said, and introduced Anakin. Charza issued something like a chuckle.
"Jedi young have big eyes when they come aboard the Star Sea Flower."
Charza took them down a narrow tunnel toward the center of the fuselage and brushed against a large chrome button. The hatch swung outward with a sigh, and warm, dry air wafted over them like a draft out of the deep deserts of Tatooine. Obi-Wan entered their travel quarters and rubbed his hands with satisfaction. "Most excellent, Charza," he said. Charza hung back, clearly uncomfortable with the dry air. The small but well-equipped room was bright and warm, equipped with 2 acceleration couches that doubled as beds. Looking up, Anakin saw they had a direct view of space through a broad circular port, radially ribbed for additional strength.
"We depart in a tenth of a tide, 1 standard hour," Charza announced. "There are waterproof boots that will adjust to fit should you decide to keep me company forward in the pilot house. That would bring me no end of delight."
Charza backed away, and the hatch closed. Anakin dropped his small bag in a closet.
"Now, can you tell me where we're going?"
Obi-Wan stowed his own travel kit and sat on the end of 1 couch. "I won't know all the details until we match our data card with Charza's. I do know this. The Jedi receive knowledge of a world in the Gardaji Rift, within the Tingalam, far beyond the bounds of Republic rule. There had been intelligence from freelance traders about an outlying community that built exceptional starships, small personal craft, sleek and beautifully made, and rated easily at 0.4. Anakin's eyes goggled. He sat across from Obi-Wan, eager to hear more. The rumors were associated with a mysterious planet called Sikot by some. Zonama Sikot, sources told us, is the actual name of the planet, which circles a small dwarf star at the far spinward and galactic north side of the rift. But charts from expeditions in that region of 2 centuries past show only rocky rubble, nothing alive, certainly. Still, other sources confirmed that a kind of diffuse trade route had been established and that rich connoisseurs of star travel were coming by secret appointment to have ships made. While the ships have been noticed in certain systems, no one in Republic security has ever examined one in detail.
Sounds like a legend, Anakin said. Maybe a hoax.
Perhaps. However, an intrusion was reported 3 years ago in the Gadaji region from an unknown spacefaring species. It was that which Vergaer was sent to investigate and, incidentally, to see if she could locate Zanama Sikote. She found the planet and sent to our farthest outlying station a brief message, all she could manage to transmit. But nothing has been heard of her since. The transmission was garbled. We have only interesting fragments.
And what did she find? Anakin asked.
A world covered with dense jungle of a kind never observed before, huge tree-like life forms, and hidden factories producing these private ships. Her report did little more than confirm that the legend was true.
Anakin shook his head in wonder. Rugged, he said admiringly. Absolutely rugged.
We'll look over the full reports once we're underway, Obi-Wan said. Now, we should join Chaza.
He's rugged too, Anakin said. I'd like to see him go up against a hut.
Chaza comes from a species devoted to peace, Obi-Wan said. He regards overt conflict as the grossest breach and would prefer to die rather than fight. Still, he is intensely intelligent and extremely ambitious.
So he makes a great spy?
A great spy master. And an extraordinarily resourceful pilot, Obi-Wan said. Wraith Synar was a very wealthy man. His scrupulous attention to markets, his extraordinary skill in managing his workers, human and otherwise, and his strategy of always keeping operations relatively small and localized had brought him profits beyond his wildest dreams in youth. Another contributor to his success had been his habit of hiding excesses. Not even Tarkin knew about his collection of failed experiments. Synar walked slowly down the long hall that lay over a kilometer beneath the central factory floor of Synar System's main Coruscant plant. Luxurious intellectual toys were his weakness, and the best of those toys were the failures of his competitors, which he had bought cheap whenever he could, saving them from the scrap heaps of technological disgrace. He keyed in his entry code to the underground museum and sniffed at the cool air, then stood for a moment in the darkness of the small antechamber, savoring the peace. Synar came here most often to think, to get away from all distractions, to make key decisions. Recognizing him, the chamber turned on its lights, and he keyed another code into the door to the museum's long underground nave. With an anticipatory sigh, Synar entered this temple of failures and smiled. 2012 exhibits of failed weapons and ship design. So many minatory admonishments. You are fallible, Wraith Synar. Always think three times before acting, and then always prepare three alternatives. A small cubicle between two larger exhibits held a rather ugly assassin droid with a long cylindrical head and rudimentary thorax. These assassins had failed on two accounts. They were depressingly obvious in appearance, and they were likely to go completely out of control and kill their makers. Synar kept it here because a former classmate from Rygovian Technical University had been involved in the design, and this very unit had killed her. It was a cautionary reminder not to overstep one's competence. Anticipating a change in political psychology, Synar had recently begun to contemplate his own weaknesses, his own narrow focus. He had always preferred elegance, finesse, and pinpoint expression of power. And he had always dealt with leaders who, more or less, agreed. Who would replace such a ruling class? Those who espoused elegance and finesse? He did not think so. Those who replace effete elites rule by brutality. This was a law in the history of the galaxy, a kind of political balance, frightening, but true. Months ago, coming at his craft from another angle, brutal and centralized strength, Synar had begun work on the expeditionary battle planetoid, whose design had so entranced Tarkin. Tarkin's reaction suggested Synar's guess had hit its mark. These new leaders might be far more impressed by high melodrama than style. Tarkin himself had always been easily impressed by size and brute force.
That was why Sinar had kept up their friendship. Tarkin was astute politically and militarily, but in Sinar's own expertise, the machines of transportation and war, he was decidedly inferior. Tarkin had admitted as much in their interview. Yet, admitting a weakness, the need for a partner, was unlike Tarkin in so many ways. Who was playing with whom? "Most interesting," a voice behind him said. Sinar nearly jumped out of his skin. Spinning about, he looked between two cubicles and saw the tall, thin form of Tarkin, half in shadow, his gray eyes gleaming like small silver beads. Standing tall behind him, a being with multi-jointed limbs, an incredibly broad nose, and iridescent gold skin, watched Sinar closely. "Suddenly, I find there's very little time, and we need something from you," Tarkin said. "No time even for simple manners between old friends?" "None at all," Tarkin said grimly. "The old ways are dying. We have to adapt. I have adapted. Sinar, you are either with us on this venture, or we move without you. But I must have a certain piece of information. If you decide against joining us, and give us that information, then out of respect for our friendship and knowing you can keep a few secrets if there's profit in it, my young acquaintance here will not kill you." Sinar knew he could not afford the time to be surprised. To ask how Tarkin and his associate happened to gain access to his private sanctuary would be fruitless, and, in the discourse of the moment, possibly even rude. "You want something from me," Sinar rephrased with a wry smile. "Something you don't think I'll give willingly. But all you had to do was ask, Tarkin." Tarkin ignored this. Sinar sensed desperation. "You were once a major subcontractor in a retrofit of the YT light trade class of vessels. You placed a tracking unit in the integument of every vessel, one you could activate with a private code, and you did not reveal this fact to the owners or, for that matter, to any authorities." Sinar's expression did not change as he thought, "He needs the codes necessary to switch on one of the trackers."
"Hurry," the blood carver said.
Sinar noticed the tall gold being was recovering from a number of wounds, some superficial, but at least two more serious. "Give me the ship's serial number, and I'll give you the code," Sinar said. "As a friend." "Really, Tarkin?" Tarkin gestured quickly to the blood carver. He held out a small data pad on which the number was displayed, blinking rapidly in red. It took Sinar no time at all to reconstruct the code string for that particular vessel. He had created the code based on an equation that utilized the serial number. He told them the code, and the blood carver entered it into his comlink and transmitted it. "The tracker will be useless in hyperspace," he told Tarkin. "It's low power and unreliable at extreme distances. I've since learned how to build better. We'll have a newer tracker partner with yours before the ship leaves orbit." "A senatorial vessel?" Sinar asked. Tarkin shook his head. "Owned by an auxiliary of the Jedi."
"I see.
What more can I offer?" Tarkin finally saw fit to smile, but it did not make him seem any friendlier.
"A great deal, Wraith, now that I'm sure you're with us."
"Wouldn't dream otherwise," Sinar said softly.
"How would you like to command an expedition?"
"To this exotic planet you spoke of earlier?"
"Yes."
"Why tell me of this world before now, if you couldn't trust me enough to give you such a thing as a tracker code?"
"Because I have recently been informed that, to you, this world was no secret. You know the planet is real. You actually hold a Sikotan ship."
Sinar did not like being caught out in a ruse, however innocent. "A dead hulk," he said defensively, "acquired from a corrupt Trade Federation lieutenant who had killed its owner. The ships are useless unless their owners are alive."
"Good to know. How many of these ships have been manufactured, do you think?"
"Perhaps 100.
"Out of 20 million spacecraft, registered and unregistered, in the known galaxy, and how much do they cost their owners?" I'm not sure. Millions, Sinar said.
You have always thought yourself smarter than me, one step ahead of me, Tarkin said tightly. Always on top of things. But this time, I can save your career and perhaps your life. We can pool our sources and our resources and both come out far ahead.
Of course, Tarkin, Sinar said evenly. I've expected a partnership between us for some time. Is now the time, and is this the place, for a good, firm handshake? Obi-Wan and Anakin donned their boots and joined Charza in the pilot house in the starboard nacelle. Anakin stood beside a line of small, hard-shelled, many-clawed creatures that fidgeted in the pool of water behind the pilot's backless couch. Obi-Wan stooped to sit in a smaller empty seat on the opposite side of the couch. Using controls mounted on struts that curved along his sides, Charza pulled the ship away from the orbital dock and engaged the sublight engines. For its age, the YT-1150 accelerated with remarkable smoothness, and in minutes they were out of Coruscant orbit, moving for the point where they would make their jump into hyperspace.
Wraith, you've been angling for this kind of opportunity for years, Tarkin said as he poured a glass of Chimbak wine from Alderaan. Tarkin's private apartment was small but choice, high on the residential level of Prime Senate Spire, 2 kilometers higher than most of the city. Whether you knew it or not, you've always wanted to be there for the dawn of a new way of doing business. Sinar was not a drinking man, but for the time being he was being friendly and cooperative. He did not enjoy the presence of the blood carver. He took the glass and pretended to savor it. His ring told him the thick red fluid was neither drugged nor poisoned, the merest comforting twinkle in its bright green stone.
You still haven't introduced me, Sinar said. Tarkin turned to the blood carver.
This is Ki Dive, from a famous political family on Batarine. Ki Dive was formerly in a select assassination corps loosely affiliated with the Trade Federation, some last inept attempt to exact a measure of revenge against the Jedi, I believe.
Blood carvers are not known to be involved in outside politics, Sinar observed.
I am an individual, Ki Dive declared. Opportunity expands with freedom from the past.
Sinar finished his glass and complimented Tarkin's taste. Tarkin nodded to Ki Dive, and the blood carver left them. Impressive, Sinar observed, when the narrow door had closed.
It could take decades to make humans the supreme race in this galaxy, Tarkin said with a sniff. The tolerance and weakness of our predecessors have made it necessary to be magnanimous for the time being.
He listened to a tiny beep on his comlink.
Our quarry has departed from Coruscant orbit. The tracker is in place and is communicating with your unit.
What will the Nemoidians do, and all the other founding members of the Trade Federation, when they discover they are expendable? This new deal with the Senate could easily cause trouble all by itself.
Let us just say that we have some powerful forces behind us, forces even I shudder to consider.
Sinar wondered if perhaps they shared the same nightmares.
Tarkin said, Let's discuss more immediate matters, however. This is a high-stakes game we're involved in. Eventually I hope to be awarded a provincial governorship and to control many star systems. You will be selling equipment to whatever political force emerges from this turmoil. Together, we can find this mysterious planet and exploit it to our mutual advantage.
It is intriguing, Sinar said.
I won't be able to go with you, unfortunately, Tarkin said. I have to keep my juggling act here on Coruscant for the time being, but you will be well equipped.
His comlink beeped again.
Now come a few tense days, he continued. Our ship of interest has entered hyperspace. We have positioned subspace transponders at several points within a few hundred light-years of where this planet is likely to be.
So, I'll be dealing with an entire planet as a commander of former Trade Federation forces?
Of droids, with a small contingent of ship's crew and troops, Tarkin said. Your crew and adjutants will all be Trade Federation trained, of course. Kidai will go with you. He has experience working with Trade Federation weaponry, and he will answer directly to me.
Fine, Sinar said, but thought differently. He had never fancied droid armies. Droids, in his opinion, were poor replacements for living troops. They were limited in intelligence and flexibility. Tarkin seemed to sense his distaste.
You'll be using a new variety of battle droid, he said. These have enhanced intelligence, are no longer centrally controlled. The Trade Federation has learned from recent debacles.
Good, Sinar said, still less than enthused. He tapped his chin in speculation. Kidai failed on a mission, yet this looks like a promotion to be moved from failed assassin to assistant commander of... what? A fleet?
A squadron, actually,
Tarkin said. He made a face.
In some respects, this is awkward.
Let me guess. Dark forces are playing with us all, and Kidaiv has connections. Non-human connections that are still useful? Tarkin did not answer this.
Just prepare, Wraith, he said. And for all our sakes, don't ask too many questions.
Anakin had been exhausted by the day's events and was sound asleep. Obi-Wan listened to the steady rhythm of the boy's breath. Obi-Wan lay back on his couch, both hearing and feeling the tingle and thrum of the hyperdrive. They were well away, yet Obi-Wan felt a distinct unease. There was something about this mission. Perhaps what bothered Obi-Wan was that he would be entirely in charge of Anakin. In the temple, Anakin had been surrounded by many Jedi and Jedi auxiliaries, including the staff, who had taken some of the burden off of him. The truth was, Obi-Wan was not sure he was up to the task. The boy was quick, charming at times, but more than a handful. The danger, and it was a real danger, was that Anakin could not and did not exercise proper control over his talents, his brilliance, his power. He was, most of the time, just a boy on the edge of manhood, and liable to all the mistakes one would normally expect. It had not happened yet, but Obi-Wan was certain that someday soon the danger would come not from boyish energy and adventurous hijinks, but from a misapplication of the Force. Perhaps that was what caused him unease. He drew himself into an alert, meditative state.
You do not trust yourself yet, Jedi. You do not trust your unconscious connection to the Force.
Obi-Wan turned his head and looked around the darkened cabin. That had sounded like Qui-Gon Jinn speaking, yet he had heard nothing. Nor had the boy made a sound. Strange that this did not disturb Obi-Wan more.
No, Master. I do not,
Obi-Wan said to the empty air.
That is my strength.
Qui-Gon would have debated that point fiercely, but there was no reply. Tarkin walked between the security droids, ignoring their warnings. Astonishingly, he carried a Senate-grade ionic disruptor, which rendered the droids harmless. Sinar smiled grimly. Fortunately, Tarkin had come this time without his blood carver.
Good morning, Wraith, Tarkin called out cheerfully. I need to view this Sokotan ship of yours, now.
By all means, Sinar said pleasantly.
Next time, you should give me some warning. Not all of my security droids are vulnerable to disruptors, you know. It's good I expected your rudeness and programmed them to recognize you. Otherwise, they would have shot you as soon as you passed through that door.
Tarkin looked over his shoulder and paled slightly.
I see, he said, putting away the disruptor. No harm done?
Not this time, Sinar said. Sinar switched on a few key lights around the echoing hangar.
Just this hulk cost me 100 million credits, he told Tarkin.
As you can see, the ship's not in very good shape.
Tarkin walked around the scabrous hulk in its shimmering refrigeration field. The once graceful curves had subsided into a wrinkled, deflated mass, despite the deep freezing and less obvious efforts at preservation.
It's biological, Tarkin observed, nose wrinkling.
I thought you would have known that already. I didn't think it was this organic, he said. I had been told that the Sokotan ships were in some sense alive, but not much use when dead, are they?
A curiosity like some preserved deep-sea monstrosity, Sinar said. As for understanding its capabilities, well, there's not much left to analyze.
I have some images, Tarkin said. Ships in outlying ports taking on fuel.
And nutrients, no doubt, Sinar said. He probably had the same images.
Is it plant or animal?
Neither. It cannot reproduce by itself, no cellular structure, but dense and varied tissues that can incorporate both metals and a variety of high-strength, heat-resistant polymers. A marvel. But without its owner, it quickly dies and quickly decays.
Reminiscent of Gungan technology on Naboo, perhaps,
Tarkin suggested.
Perhaps, Sinar said.
The Gungans manufacture their ships from organic matter, but the ships are not themselves alive. This seems to be very different. Before your generous offer, I was looking for an owner willing to allow me access to a fully functioning Sokotan ship. So far, however, there are no takers. It seems secrecy is part of the contract, and betrayal could end an owner's relationship with his vessel. This was the best I could do. Tarkin permitted himself a small smile.
I had a feeling you'd be up on all this, Wraith, he said. Keep your schedule open, my friend. Something could happen at any minute.
Of course, Wraith said. My time is yours, Tarkin. I am patient.
When the Padawan and his master entered the pilot house, Charza Quinn was surrounded by a host of helpers and kin. Obi-Wan had not seen them all together before. The sight was impressive. There did not seem to be a square centimeter of the bridge's equipment that was not attended by several creatures, ranging in size from the food kin, the small crab-like creatures that Charza ate, about as broad as his hand, to meter-long replicas of Charza himself. Charza sat on his backless couch, waving tools clutched in his spikes. He shifted his bristles slightly around his spiracles to imitate human speech.
Welcome. The quarters are comfortable?
Quite, Obi-Wan said.
I'll tell you more now about this place you go to. First, size. Zonamas Sikote is 9,000 salt pans broad. That is, in Republic measure, 11,000 kilometers. Its star system is a triple. In a hidden region of the Gadaji Rift, surrounded by great dust clouds, Zonamas Sikote circles the third star. It is almost impossible to find if you don't know the way. Now,
Charza said, leaning to one side and pulling two heavy parallel levers,
we come out of hyperspace.
With a sharp lurch, the stars returned, and the distinctive flaming red and purple pinwheel that dominated the skies of Zonamas Sikote.
Wow!
Anakin said, eyes wide. The display was stunning. Perhaps the most beautiful he had ever seen.
Where's our planet?
The boy asked eagerly.
Zonamas Sikote's sun is behind us,
Charza said.
These two spectacular dancers, the red giant and the white dwarf with their long spiral tails, are its companions.
The pinwheel began as a ribbon of star stuff pulled from the red giant. It then curled around the white dwarf, which flung it outward in interwoven braids of ionized gas.
You can see Zonamas Sikote itself. It is that tiny green point just ahead.
Charza grabbed a long rod with his bristles and tapped it on the port.
When I came to the planet last, I released Verger on a mountain plateau high in the northern hemisphere. I fervently hope she is still alive.
It is believed she is alive, Obi-Wan said.
Perhaps,
Charza said with a chuffing of his bristles.
There are no pirates here, no commerce centers. Indeed, the only inhabited planet for many light years is Zonamasikot, but Zonamasikot is very close to the edge of the galaxy. Beyond this point, there is much that is not known. Anything could happen.
The edge of the galaxy,
Anakin said, still entranced by the picture.
We could be the first beings to go beyond the edge.
He looked at Obi-Wan.
If we wanted to.
There are still frontiers, Obi-Wan agreed.
Zonamasikot itself is not empty,
Charza said.
There are beings there, not native to the planet. They arrived many years ago, not known how long. But they invite guests only in the last 10 years, mostly rich buyers from worlds that prosper, but do not owe strong allegiance to the Republic or trade with the Trade Federation. I will show you a picture that Verger sent to my ship before I left the system.
Charza chuffed orders to a cluster of foodkin perched on one console. They danced on buttons and tugged levers, and a viewer swung into place. Obi-Wan and Anakin leaned forward and stared. An intensely green landscape, viewed at sunset, spread before them. The scale of tree-like growths that filled most of the image was not immediately apparent until Anakin spotted a structure in the lower left, a kind of balcony with what looked like humans standing on it. Then it became apparent the trees were easily 500 or 600 meters tall, and that the great green domes of foliage in the upper right were easily hundreds of meters across. Green was the dominant color, but the foliage was also rich with gold, blue, purple, and red.
They do not look like trees, Obi-Wan commented.
Not trees, Charza said. Not trees at all. Verger called them boras.
The planet's yellow sun, setting in a golden haze between the ranks of huge growths, was not the only light in the sky. The vast pinwheel of red and purple gas covered all they could see of the northern sky beyond the Boras.
That is all I know, Charza continued. I dropped off Verger, then waited until I was dismissed and returned to orbit. There was no message to retrieve her, so I departed as she had ordered. At that time, I detected 6 ships of known types in the region. All were private craft, I think, belonging to customers of the shipbuilders on Zonamasikot.
You did well, Charza, Obi-Wan said, getting to his feet. Perhaps nothing is amiss.
She may be alive, Charza said, but I do not think all is well. Where one Jedi travels alone, perhaps no cause for alarm. Where a Jedi falls silent and other Jedi follow, mishap and adventure.
Tarkin marched ahead of Wraith Sinar toward the waiting shuttle.
There is no time to lose, Tarkin shouted over his shoulder. They've emerged from hyperspace and we've received the tracker signal. We have less than an hour before you must join your squadron and leave Coruscant.
Sinar clutched his travel bag and passed last-minute information to his protocol droid, a small disk containing special instructions should he not return within a specified period of time. Sinar joined Tarkin inside the well-appointed shuttle lounge. The shuttle immediately pulled from its tower berth and rose rapidly into orbit.
I hope you understand what could be at stake here, Tarkin said, his thin face grim. At the moment, we are below the level of awareness of those who will command the galaxy. If this planet and its ships are as useful as they appear to be,
we will be richly rewarded. We will be noticed.
Some already share my belief that this could be very big.
I keep an independent mind, Sinar said.
In the long run, that could be extremely unwise, Tarkin told him, and his gray eyes narrowed to slits.
Charza Quinn brought the Star Seaflower into a high orbit over Zonamasikot. As Obi-Wan and Anakin prepared their belongings in the dry cabin, Obi-Wan brought out a pouch he had concealed in his robes. Anakin looked at it hopefully.
Another lightsaber? He asked.
Obi-Wan smiled and shook his head. Not yet, Padawan. Something more appropriate for a planet run by merchants. Old-style erodium credits. 3 billions worth. In several large ingots.
I've never
seen that many credits,
Anakin said, stepping closer, and Obi-Wan opened the packet. The 10 pure erodium ingots sparkled like tiny flames. Each held a depth of mysterious light that refused to fix on one color.
What they say about the temple is true, then,
Anakin mused.
That it holds secret treasure?
Hardly. These were drawn from a joint account in the Galactic Capital Bank. Many in the galaxy lend their resources to support the Jedi. Verger carried a similar amount with her. It is rumored that this is sufficient to purchase a Sokotan vessel.
Let's hope the rumors are correct.
But Verger, maybe she's already bought a ship,
Anakin said.
It may be necessary for us to be completely ignorant of Verger.
Oh, right.
Obi-Wan rolled up the ingots and tied the cord, then handed it to Anakin. Keep it with you at all times.
Wizard!
Anakin enthused.
No one suspect a boy would carry this much cash.
He stuffed the packet into his tunic and strapped it close to his body with the long remainder of cord. While they waited for the planet's answer to their landing request, Anakin sat in the small side seat on the bridge, with his elbows propped on his knees, watching Zanamasi Coat. He had performed his first set of exercises for the day, and his thoughts were particularly clear. It seemed sometimes, when he had tamed his turbulence for the moment, that he was no longer a boy or even a human. His perspective seemed crystalline and universal, and he felt as if he could see all his life laid out before him, filled with accomplishment and heroism, selfless heroism, of course, as befitted a Jedi. Somewhere in that life would be a woman, though Jedi did not often marry. He imagined the woman to be like Queen Amidala of Naboo, a powerful personality in her own right, lovely and dignified, yet sad and shouldered with great burdens which Anakin could help lift. He had not spoken with Amidala in years, nor with his mother, Shmi, but in his present frame of disciplined consciousness, their memory acted on him like a distant and ineffable music. He shook his head and, turning his feelings outward, focused them until they seemed to make a bright point between his eyes. He concentrated on Zanamasi Coat to see what he could see. Many paths to many futures flowed from any single moment, and yet, by being in tune with the Force, an adept could chart the most likely path for his awareness to follow. Anakin was sure he was doing something like that now. It felt as if the cells in his body were tuned to a severely faded signal from the future, more of a sound than a stimulus to any other sense. That sound was a voice, large and heavy as if weighed down, unlike any other voice he had ever heard. His body shuddered, one eye closed slightly and his head tilted to one side. Then he quickly closed both eyes and shuddered again. The spell was broken. The moment had lasted perhaps 3 seconds. Anakin tried to remember something large and beautiful, an emotion or a state of mind he had just touched upon, but all he could conjure was the face of Shmi smiling at him sadly and proudly, like a protective scrim over any other memory. His mother still so important and so far away. He could never see the face of a father. Obi-Wan sloshed into the pilot house.
You look thoughtful.
I'm allowed, aren't I? Anakin asked.
As long as you don't brood, Obi-Wan said.
The look on his master's face was both irritated and concerned. Anakin suddenly jumped out of his chair and hugged his master with a fierceness that took Obi-Wan by surprise. Obi-Wan held the boy gently and let the moment flow into its own shape. Some Padawans were as simple as quiet pools. Only in training did they acquire the depth and complexity that showed maturity. Anakin had been a deep and complex mystery from the first day they had met, and yet Obi-Wan had never felt such a strength of connection with any other being, not even Qui-Gon Jinn. Anakin drew back and looked up at his master.
I think we're going to face real trouble down there, he said.
I've suspected as much, Obi-Wan agreed.
Wraith Sinar entered the observation deck of his flagship, the Admiral Corvin, and stepped up on the commander's platform.
He looked over the weapons arrayed within the circular assembly bay of the former Trade Federation heavy munitions cruiser, an antiquated hulk. Tarkin had either not described the force accurately, or he had remembered it with blind optimism. Sinar flipped up the weapons list. E-5 droids. His lips curled. The cruiser carried 100 Trade Federation troops and over 3,000 offensive and defensive droids. Three smaller and decidedly less useful vessels completed the squadron that Tarkin was now handing over to him. It was not inconceivable that one could conquer a planet with these ships, a backwater planet in the dark ages of technology, but nothing more advanced than that, and conquer, but not then control. "You are not impressed," Tarkin said dryly, joining him on the platform. "I have never believed in droids as frontline fighters," Sinar told him. "Not even these new ones. Nabu was lost, even though the forces deployed by the Trade Federation were hundreds of times larger than this. As I told you, these droids have been altered to be capable of independence, and they are considerably more rugged than earlier models," Tarkin said with some irritation. "Would you trust them to carry out a complicated battle plan on their own?" "I might," Tarkin said, sucking in his cheeks. "I must say, Wraith, I don't prize complete independence as much as you seem to. The Nemoidians gave Central Control a bad name. The controllers on this ship are quite competent and flexible. Zonama Sikote is only lightly populated, as you well know. These should be more than sufficient, and they are the best I can put together. The Trade Federation squadrons are being handed over to Republic control day by day, and this is all they could hold aside."
"Spare me the weepy details," Sinar said coldly. "You have put me in charge rather than go yourself, though you are the more experienced in battle tactics. Failure of this mission will taint the commander, will taint me, irrevocably."
"Now who's engaging in weepy details?" Tarkin asked even more coldly. "We must make do with what we have. I chose you because you are nearly my equal in tactics, and you will understand Zonama Sikote's factories better than I ever could."
Sinar regarded Tarkin narrowly. "Looking at this equipment, I'm not at all sure of your motives."
"There you go again," Tarkin said, trying for a tone of amusement. "You have a large capacity and heavily armored flagship and three utility vessels, a Taxon-class probe ship, a fleet diplomatic boat that can double as a decoy, and a mobile astromech repair station. Battle droids, transport craft equipped with sky mines, your squadron is more than sufficient to accomplish our mission."
"And you'll be in just the right place to repair any damage my failure might cause?" Sinar asked.
"I am staying on Coruscant to support the effort politically. That is likely to be far more difficult than conquering a jungle planet."
Tarkin drew himself up.
"I must return to Coruscant. Ah, here is Captain Kett."
The captain of the Admiral Corvin approached Sinar, bowing his head quickly before speaking.
"We are to leave orbit in 20 minutes, Commander. There is one last load of weapons to take aboard. Droid starfighters, I believe. They will be stowed in 10 minutes.
"There, Wraith," Tarkin said. "More than I hoped for. If you can't win this planet with starfighters, well..."
Sinar acknowledged Kett's message with a curt twist of his head.
"Allow me to escort you to the transport deck," he said to Tarkin.
"No need," Tarkin said.
"I insist," Sinar told him. "It is the way things are done, on my ship. And it would also